Good morning, everyone. We're going to go ahead and get started on with the Senate Committee on Judiciary, so we'll go call it to order. Just give everyone an opportunity to kind of know where we're at for today. We have three bills for public hearing and three for a work session. The third bill that we have scheduled is 592. We are planning on having testimony on that. The amendments for the bill, and that was at my request, have arrived, and so staff will be getting those, and we'll be trying to distribute them. And if necessary, we'll continue public hearing on that particular bill if it need be. But hopefully we'll be able to get stuff out there so everyone kind of knows where we're at before we go too far down that road. So with that, let's see, we're going to go and get started with the first public hearing, which is on Senate Bill 67. I will open that public hearing at this time.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 67, excuse me, allows the Department of State Police to publish specified information about predatory, sexually violent sex offenders on its website by city, zip code, or county. It declares emergency and is effective on passage. Law enforcement agencies and entities that supervise sex offenders in Oregon are required to release information about sex offenders upon request as necessary to protect the public. Senate Bill 67 would allow Internet publication of information about predatory and sexually violent offenders absent any request.
All right. Thank you. So I have, it looks like, four people who have signed up for this, and I will call a panel of three. That's Daniel Meister, I believe, Vi, Betty, and Matt Brimrose, if y'all three would come forward at this time. And I'm not sure who wants to, quote, unquote, take the lead, but if you have a order that you'd like to follow, that's fine with the chair.
Do I start?
You start.
Okay. Sorry. It was an interesting drive from Oregon City this morning.
Yeah. Well, thank you for being here. I know that for a lot of people, the travel was a little more difficult than on a normal morning for our meetings.
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Vi Beatty. Manager of the Sex Offender Registry for the state of Oregon. I'm employed by Oregon State Police to do that. Senate Bill 67 actually does a little bit more than allow us to post predatory and sexually violent dangerous offenders. It allows us to take our basic list information on registered sex offenders and post that to the Internet for the public to obtain a list without having to call our office or email our office and have us send them a hard copy or an email copy of a list. They could just get it through the Internet. This bill came forward because one of the number one requests we receive from the public in the registry is, why can't I get the information through the Internet? Our neighboring states of Washington, Idaho, Utah, California, Nevada, Nebraska, Texas all have information at different levels available through the Internet. We're trying to be the most conservative of that group just by putting our list information out. The information we're proposing to post, even though it's not listed in this bill, would be the basic information of a thumbnail photograph of the individual, their name, their date of birth, their physical descriptors, if they're under supervision, the name of their supervising agency, a contact number for that agency, the city and zip where that offender is reported residing. And that's the only information that we're proposing at this time to put out there. We are not proposing address information based on events that have occurred in other states where sex offenders have been targeted based on their address and some offenders have been killed. So we're trying to be a little bit conservative while still providing the public with the information that they are asking to receive. We're also working on some amendments right now with the Youth Rights and Justice, used to be Juvenile Rights Project, and with Oregon Youth Authority, so that it would limit the information on supervised juvenile offenders and keep that off the list information. I don't know when those amendments will be in. I believe Gail Meyer has more information on that, but we are working on amendments at this time. If you have any questions, I'm available for those.
Thank you. All right, who wants to go next?
We'll go in order, I guess. My name is Matt Bemrose. I'm the owner, president of Bemrose Consulting Incorporated in Beaverton, Oregon. We process rental applications for landlords and pre-employment background checks for employers. I'm sorry, did I say rental applications for landlords and pre-employment background checks for employers? The reason why I'm here today is to you to encourage the pass of Senate Bill 67. In my business, we rely heavily on databases that are complete and accurate. Our customers hire us because we're the experts in gathering and verifying information so they can make good decisions about renting to tenants or hiring employees. Our understanding is that there's a group of names that are not included on the registry. When names are not available, it puts our customers at risk of hiring a registered sex offender unknowingly. We work for businesses that deal with the public directly, which includes families. If an employer were to hire a registered sex offender unknowingly and then send that employee out to a home or to another business, and someone, some child or minor, could be abused, not only the child is violated, but that business probably wouldn't be in business much longer. Adding the names to the list will definitely keep businesses, property, communities, and children much safer. Thanks.
Thank you, Pat. And Daniel?
Great. My name is Daniel Meister. I work at the Pacific Screening. We're a tenant screening company out of Beaverton, Oregon as well. Matt and I are competitors, but on this bill, we definitely agree.
Next to each other, we
said
love
next
it.
To having coffee this morning.
Did you carpool together?
We did not.
No,
we did not.
I put my foot down on
he's going to go solicit. He's going to go attack my customers after we're done. Thank you. I just want to read one quick little statement for one of my biggest customers, Princeton Property Management. They manage about 9,000 units in Oregon across the state.
Daniel, if I can get you to move your microphone up just a little bit, thank you.
Sure. So Princeton Property Management manages 9,000 units, probably the third largest property management company in Oregon. When she heard about this bill, she wanted to just submit a quick little letter, so I'm just going to read part of it. Unless the law changes, Princeton Property Management and our apartment communities are at risk for approving sex offenders to live in our communities. Homes where families, single moms, children, elderly, and teenagers live together. We believe that the current sex offender website puts our business and our residents' safety in jeopardy. And I'll just stop right there. It is difficult to screen sex offenders. We use multiple databases, but a complete website with all the names is really the best way to resolve some of these issues that we have. My company screens for housing authorities, Portland, Jackson County, Yamhill, and Salem Housing Authority. Part of the regulations is to screen people for sex offenses and to check the sex offender database. Right now, they cannot get the complete list. So according to the feds and HUD, they're requiring us to do the background search, and we're coming back and telling them we can't do a complete search because we can't get the information. So a little conflict between their regulations and the state right now. This bill actually resolves that situation and improves my ability to get that information. And I'll put that for you guys to see the actual site.
Okay. Great, thank you. Questions? Senator Cruz.
Mr. Chair, not so much a question, because I support this, but there is another piece of legislation dealing specifically with juvenile sex offenders, and I just want to make sure that we aren't doing one thing in one bill that counteracts something in another bill. So just be aware of that.
Are you talking about Senate Bill 408 or House Bill 2660?
I think it's
about
408, isn't it?
Yes.
Right. Actually, the amendments that we're proposing will work hand in hand with that bill, because while a juvenile is under supervision, they would not be listed through the internet anyway.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Senator Bartolomeucci.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think this question is for Ms. Beatty. If this bill will result in additional names being added to the list that aren't there now, can you please explain what those are? Or does it just permit publication of names that are already on an existing list?
It actually does both. Under current law, first-time adult convicted sex offenders information cannot be released to the public unless we receive a name query. So that group of offenders is not included on any list that we release through the registry at this point. So what this bill will do is add those adult convicted, first-time supervised persons' names to the list and allow us to post our current list with the additional names to the Internet.
Thank you.
Any other questions? I got a couple for you. I'm not sure how this is going to work out. I've got a chief of police in Florence. Currently, we've seen in that community individuals that have moved in from out of state that are sex offenders. I guess they are identified in California as such. He is looking for how can he give notice as to those individuals being in the community, and he's had some issues as to, I guess, would have to have some type of formal hearing or process that would actually, I guess, identify them as sex offenders before they can be, I guess, notified through our system, and where he could actually take that information to the community. Now, I've worked a little bit with Legislative Council, and they've given me this kind of perspective of how this can be done. I'm wondering if what we're looking at, if this is somehow going to open that door to allow for those communities that have people relocating from out of state that in all intent purposes would have met the criteria for being required to be reported here.
I think you're referring to Senate Bill 923. I looked at it last night.
I think that's correct.
And currently under Oregon law, the only people that we can put on the Internet are those who are designated predatory. And predatory in Oregon is the highest risk of reoffending. It requires a risk assessment using a tool determined by Department of Corrections. It requires for me to do someone who's moving into state. It takes 2 weeks to review a file once I get all the documents from the state of conviction or states of conviction. So it's a very lengthy process. It can take anywhere from 4 months to a year. And that's where Chief Saunders is coming from. If we could post our list information to the Internet, then all the sex offender information or the names of the sex offenders in a community are listed on the Internet as opposed to only those deemed predatory. So we're diverging from current statute and saying, okay, instead of only just the highest risk to reoffend, we would like to put the names of all of the offenders, except, of course, the juveniles under supervision, out on the Internet so that the public can see who's there.
Okay. All right. Any other questions or comments for this panel? I want to thank you all very much for making the drive down. I know travel at this time is not always the safest or the best conditions, so thank you very much for being here. And, Vi, if you can maybe come by the office, I'd like to follow up on that bill.
Set an appointment.
That would be great. Thank you very much. The other person I have scheduled for giving testimony on Senate Bill 67 is Gail Meyer. Gail, why don't you come on up? Is there anyone else who wants to give testimony today on Senate Bill 67?
Members of the committee, Gail Meyer, on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. Of the other organizations that were interested in this bill, the ACLU of Oregon and the Youth Rights and Justice, I was designated the Me Too speaker. So they were going to be far more informed and have a written testimony, and they're not here today. So, here's in answer to Senator Cruz's question, the Youth Rights and Justice, formerly the Juvenile Rights Project, is working closely with Oregon State Police, I think, to structure some amendments that will protect juveniles who are under supervision. And they are also the proponent of the other bill relating to juvenile registration. So it will be coordinated, and I don't think that it will be one person doing one thing and someone else doing another. So there will be a coordinated effort there. There are concerns about releasing the information in ways in which you cannot track now who's making the request. Under existing law right now, if someone wants to get a list of registered sex offenders in their zip code, they have to call the Oregon State Police up and they say, can I please have this information? So they then either mail it or they email it, but Oregon State Police knows who has made the query. It's unclear to me, based on this statute, that they will really be able to identify now who is making the query. Now, granted, they are not giving addresses, home addresses. They are listing the individual within a zip code, but not their addresses. But there have been instances of vigilantism and hostility in other states, and so it's good that Oregon has been conservative in this way. We are losing a bit of accountability here when we proceed now to simply doing this electronically. Secondly, there has been a protection always for an offender who is under supervision for the first time. And I want to segregate out as a special class those offenders who have been designated as predators. If someone's been designated as a predatory sex offender, our current statutes allow them to be on the internet with pictures posted. So what we're talking about here now are offenders who have not been designated as predators. They could be very low risk. And they could be under supervision for the first time. And again, we worry about just making sure that the information is available that needs to be available for the public, for public safety, but that there not be over disclosure of this, because again, to look at some charges doesn't necessarily convey the underlying circumstance. It could be a consensual relationship with more than 3 years between them. It could be anything. So we just have those concerns. OCDLA really hasn't taken a formal position on the bill, but we just note that we don't want to go to a position of other states where there has been some hostilities and violence against these registered offenders.
Questions?
No, Ms. Senator Cruz first. Ms. Chair, just the comment, now that I've gotten totally used to JRP, they go change their name. I just think that's unfair.
All right. Senator Wissa, did you have? All right. Gail, thank you very much.
Yeah.
I didn't think I'd say anything on the other side of the dice. And then I understand Robert West. Mr. West, come forward.
Yes, my name is Robert West, and I'm against the bill. One concern that I have is someone that committed a sex offense, say in their teens, and say they get 70, 80, 90 years old, they're not a sex offender, but they still have to register as a sex offender. If you put their names on the list, even though they're not a danger to the public, you still have the chance of retaliation against the individuals. My understanding is there is no time in which the registration can expire. It's a lifetime registration. So my concern is not just for, I look at the public safety, but I also look at people that change their lives and decided they, don't want to do it. They might be happily married or something like that, and to put their name on a list where them or their family could be retaliated against seems, unjust. And so that's why I'm against it.
Okay.
If I'd be for it if they had some kind of time limit in which, say you committed a sex offense 20 years ago, but since changed your life, and the state goes, well, we're not going to post you, or we're not going to put you on the internet. And that's just basically my concern, is people that went past that and stuff like that. I also have other disagreements law as far as the registration goes, too, and the elderly, you know, someone with Alzheimer's, do they have to register? Well, under the law, yes. You know, do they have the mental ability to? No. You know, but my concern right now is for the elderly. And the older people that committed sex offenses in the past that can't necessarily defend themselves when they're attacked because their face is on the internet. And you, people will spot them in stores. People see them in restaurants. People see them walking down the street. And it only takes a couple 19, 20, 21-year-olds to beat up a couple old people, and they say, well, hey, you know, the state was the one that victimized me. They put me on the internet, and because of that, I got beat up. You know, yeah, there's not too much sympathy for sex offenders, but they still have rights to be protected by the state, and to put them in a situation where they're endangered is like in California and Washington, where they've had sex offenders retaliated against. And that's my opposition to it, is that there's no time limits in which register or such notification, you know.
Thank you very much. Let's see if there's any questions.
Mr. West, thank you very much for coming forward today. Again, is there anyone else who'd like to give testimony on Senate Bill 67? Not seeing anyone, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 67. We're going to open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 186.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 186 requires appellants to the Land Use Board of Appeals to have ownership interest in property within a set number of miles of the property affected by a disputed land use decision.
All right, thank you. I have three people that are scheduled to give testimony today. I'm going to go ahead and know that we have a kumbaya moment here. So John Chandler, Jonathan Manton, and Steve McCoy, want all three of you come up together.
Mr. Chair, can I speak? It's my bill. Can I speak to it?
Sure, you can speak to it.
I'll just do it from here, if that's
well,
okay.
Yeah, no, we're very informal here.
Okay, thank you. While the panel's setting up, first off, let me say this bill, there's amendments coming. It is not quite crafted the way I wanted it, but I got it in time, and I have the relating clause I need, so that was the important thing. Mr. Chair, committee members, for the record, Senator Jeff Cruz, and the reason for this bill, first of all, let me say that the governor has said all along that jobs are number one priority, and he is taking a hard look at industrial lands, among other things. I think it's time to take a hard look at the process we have for commercial property and for other things. We have a land use system in the state. Each county has a land use plan that has been approved by the state, and to go through that process can be rather onerous at times. On top of that, we have if people affected don't like the decision that the county has come up with, they can take the case to the Land Use Board of Appeals, and that's appropriate as well. But in talking to judges, and it's one thing I have learned over time here is that where I used to blame lawyers and judges, I don't anymore. And the reason I don't is because they are working within the structure of the law as it is. And so if we are not getting the outcomes that we think we should be getting through the process, it falls upon us to make the laws say what we want them to say. And in the case of appeals to LUBA, at this point in time, the language in statute is vague enough, basically, to allow anybody to appeal a land use decision anywhere. And quite honestly, I don't think having, you know, and you can do it relatively inexpensively, at least on the front end. And so, you know, once a land use decision has been made in Baker County, for example, I'm not sure it's appropriate for somebody from Coos Bay to be able to appeal that decision and delay process. And And in a lot of cases, just the delay after delay after delay in process can stop a project because time is money. So what I was wanting to do in this bill, and when we get the amendments, is to make sure that we redefine standing for a case to come before LUBA to those that actually have some interest in the land use decision that was made. And it needs to be defined the way it is now, that the statute is so vague as to allow anybody from anywhere to appeal and take a case to LUBA. And what I would like is to have, and we will, there'll be some fine tuning on the language, clearly, just to own, to say that only people that own property can appeal is much narrower than I had in mind. But there has to be some interest other than, yeah, it doesn't sound like a good thing what they're doing way over there 500 miles away, so we're going to appeal it. So the design of this is to try to still ensure that the appeal process is in place, but only for those who have really an interest in what the project is. And the hope of this is that because time is money, we can streamline the process to a degree that we can have certainty in our land use decisions so that worthwhile projects can go forward and not be appealed forever. Like I said, there will be amendments coming, and I thank you for having this hearing, and we will have a conversation when we see what the amendments are like.
All right, so before we go with the testimony, just to clarify what I was listening to, what I think the amendments proposed will include: redefine standing to limit it to someone who has an interest, and then someone that owned property.
Well, that's what's in here right now is owns real property or has an ownership interest in real property with an X distance. But I think I want it to be a little broader than I mean, you know, ownership is one thing, but has an, you know, it is affected, but in a more real way than the statute currently allows that interpretation to be. And from my mind, the problem is that the terminology in law right now is so vague that basically the court can't deny an appeal from anywhere, and we just want to narrow that up.
Okay. Thank you for the clarification. John, do you want to, Chandler, do you want to start since you're for the position?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, John Chandler, Oregon Home Builders Association, I appreciate Senator Cruz's clarification. The bill in front of you is a trifle vague as printed. And my testimony this morning will be based on the note of the underlying concept of the bill, not the bill itself, if you don't mind, Senator.
Or the amendment either.
Or the amendment in absentia. I do want to call the committee's attention to the fact there's a fairly robust conversation on this issue starting up in the House already. House Judiciary Committee has considered three bills, House Bills 2182, 2181, and 2610, all dealing with a very similar set of issues. There's a couple bills that have not, I think they've been printed, but they haven't been scheduled yet over on this side of the building, dealing with industrial land specifically, but in which the issue of standing and process is going to be on the table. This session seems to be shaping up around the need to, on the one hand, respect the land use system. I don't think we're going to see any major excavations, but also to recognize that there are some parts of the land use system that may interfere intentionally or inadvertently with economic development aspirations and basically making the plans functional. One of the conversations we had during the interim in the House with the Ag Committee was the fact that if one wants to protect farm and forest land, which is one of the hallmarks of Oregon's land use system, one of the best ways to do so is to make sure that the zoning designations and the planning that has been done within urban growth boundaries is allowed to be done, to be built. And to the extent that you may build at lower density or you prohibit uses or you delay development projects, that simply puts more pressure on the urban growth boundary and by extension then more pressure on our resource land. So I think it's going to be a good conversation this session. This bill may well play a very important part because, as Senator Cruz pointed out, the standing requirements are very, very broad. It essentially says under current law, if you want to appear in writing, whether or not you live in the jurisdiction, whether or not you're even all that familiar with the case and want to spend $200, you can appeal a case to LUBA. And then that oftentimes local land use cases oftentimes are controversial within that locality. We believe, and I think the point of this bill is, if you are affected by it, you should have a right to squawk and to object and to appeal and point out where the infirmities are and anything else you can do. If not, perhaps the interest of the state in the land use planning program generally and in economic development specifically ought to prevail, and we ought to look at some ways of narrowing the scope of standing back in a way that respects the right of citizens and neighbors and people in the community to have their say, and not all the planning is done with enough specificity that you don't need to flesh things out in discretionary processes, but at the same time not leave it so wide open. And our concern from the development industry has been many of the land use folks who are engaged in land use appeals are sophisticated enough to know they don't have to win the appeal. They don't have to go to LUBA and prevail on the merits. They simply have to stall the project through the option window, through the financing window, or until something else happens, and the project goes away, or gets built at a lower density, or other things that may interfere, again, with those statewide goals. So, in short, Mr. Chair, members, I think the idea behind this bill is worth consideration. I would certainly like to have the opportunity to come back and speak to the amendments when the bill gets scheduled again. I would encourage you to pay attention to the extent you have time and headspace to do so to the conversations on industrial lands and on the House side, because I think there will be something coming out of this session on some reforms to the land use system that will accomplish all the goals I just mentioned. Be glad to take any questions.
All right, we're going to go ahead and go forward with other testimony. So, Steve or Jonathan, whoever wants to go next.
I am Steve McCoy, Chair Przonski, members of the committee. I am Steve McCoy. I represent 1000 Friends of Oregon. And I am here to testify in opposition of this bill and conceptually of the next concept as well, I think. The way that Oregon's land use system is set up is for citizens to enforce the laws, essentially. It's not something that DLCD does a lot of. It's not something that, for example, comes out of the AG's office all the time. It is up to the citizens to enforce the laws. And to hold local governments to the law, not only state law, but also their own ordinances and codes, is an important aspect of frankly, what we do and what people throughout the state do. There is not a huge avalanche of appeals going to LUBA. There's about 195 a year. That's averaged since 1995. It's about 5.4 per county. So we're not talking about a huge number here. Also, LUBA appeals are quick. It's a 77-day process. Is not something that you can use to hold up projects indefinitely. There are certain decisions that go to the circuit court. Those are then not expedited, and those do take a long time. If speed is of the essence, if time is of the essence, then I would say funneling those to LUBA rather than making it so that people cannot appeal illegal decisions would probably be the right way to go. What else? Zoning is a health and safety issue. Zoning is not just about an adjacent landowner, and I know we're not talking about landowners anymore, but also if you're just talking about distances, for example, you can live in one community and work in another community, for example, or your children can go to school in a different community, especially if you're talking rural areas. So distances get problematic because of that. Another point is that LUBA is already able to, or not able, it is required to award attorney fees in situations where a frivolous case is brought. And the standard that they use is a probable cause standard. So if you have a probable cause to think that the case that you're bringing has merit, in fact and in law, then it's not considered frivolous by LUBA. But if you do not have probable cause, so if you are bringing a frivolous case, then LUBA is in fact required to award attorney fees, the other side's attorney fees. Also, just to not exactly correct, but something that Mr. Chandler said about $200 to appeal to LUBA. It's actually $400. It's $200 for the filing fee and then $200 for the costs, as well as, obviously, if you're going to be represented, to hire an attorney as well. And with that, since we're not exactly talking about SB 186 as written, I think I can just take questions.
you can beat up on it later.
Oh, yeah.
Jonathan. Chair Brzozowski, members of the committee. My name is Jonathan Manton, and I'm here testifying today on behalf of Friends of the Metolius. And Friends of the Metolius is a nonprofit conservation organization that serves to protect the legacy of Oregon's heritage, the Metolius Basin. To achieve this goal, Friends of the Metolius monitors and advises U.S. Forest Service management activities within the Deschutes National Forest and within the Metolius Basin, and promotes an informed, positive response to land use issues from its members and from the public. And it's with regard to this point that I testify today in opposition to this bill, even in its concept. And I'll just be kind of brief, just add kind of maybe two quick points to the prior testimony. One is that with regard to Central Oregon in particular, there are lands within Jefferson County that are privately owned but are surrounded by federal lands, federal timberlands. And so if you use a geographic limitation on standing for a decision on one of those pieces of private property, you could potentially come up with a situation that no one would have standing to challenge a decision on that property because no one owns any private land around it. It's all surrounded by federal land. So that would be a problem just in principle of using a geographic boundary. And then the second point I'll add is to the appeals fees conversation with how much it costs to get to LUBA. Oftentimes, counties are not, there's a statutory provision that limits your first point of entry to the county with a land use application that it only costs $250 to get to a planning department or a planning director. Counties are not allowed to charge any more than that. But then to go from that decision to the full board of county commissioners, which is a step you have to exhaust before you can get to LUBA, there's no limit on what can be charged in that position. So the cost of bringing a case to LUBA is oftentimes much more than $200 or $400. You have to, in some counties, spend a lot of money just to get to exhaust your local remedies before the county commission. And otherwise, I think I'll just kind of be quiet and be open for questions at this point. Thank you for allowing my testimony today.
All right, thank you. Questions? Senator Cruz?
Yeah, maybe a comment, Mr. Chair. I just pointed out, I was suggesting my example of somebody from Coos Bay appealing a land use decision in Baker County. I would suggest in most cases that is not an individual, it's an organization, and the monetary issue is moot.
Senator Wissett.
Thank you. I would just carry that analogy a little further. As I read the current statute, you don't even have to be an Oregon resident, you just have to be a person. So perhaps if you were an animal activist living in New Jersey, you might bring an appeal on the probable cause that a egg farm would be a could be construed as animal abuse. It seems to me that that's way too broad, and I think this is a way to narrow that down. I think it needs to be a little broader than Senator Cruz's or the Legislative Council's current drafting, but the way it is now, it seems to me absurdly broad. So, Mr. Chandler, would you opine on the?
We don't have enough time in the day for it.
I just love the way John talks.
I appreciate the letter high floaters under which to keep it.
There's no grand slam here, I
no,
assure
sir.
You.
But I think what you've heard today, and I'd encourage you to attend to the other discussions, because what you've heard from my colleagues with Friends of Metolius and Thousand Friends is from a citizen activist position or a citizen activist representative position of the absolutely right. This is our system is enforced through citizen participation. That's goal one of the land use planning program. Our perspective, and I think the business and development community's perspective, is that's great. However, there are occasions when it simply goes too far and interferes with other activities. Neither side is necessarily right or wrong. It's different perspectives on the same social balancing. And one of the conundrums we have is we let our local land use decisions be made by with all respect, amateurs at the local level. It isn't judicial. It's much faster. My colleague's correct. It's much faster to go through a little bit theoretically anyway, although if they get their budget cut much more, for those of you on Ways and Means, please don't, it'll get much slower. But leaving that aside, the trade-off would be more professionalism and in the circuit courts. I'm not advocating that, but we have to keep in mind that we're asking local planning commissioners, local counselors, and commissioners to make very complicated legal decisions, which are always subject to interpretation on appeal. Almost every case has some error that on which an appeal can be hung, and 77 days or not, those go back for remand, they go back for facts, they go back for the process, and the underlying issue for us is it isn't near as certain as we think it should be. And some place that we've carved out in the statute to make it more certain, I think the industrial lands bills you're going to see will attempt to take some cases of industrial land and make it more certain. That may be a good line of inquiry rather than fiddling with the appeals process, but to look at what it applies to. Point is, and Senator Whitson is correct, it is broad now. And the question for you folks in the legislature is the balancing of public policy between a wide open or relatively wide open appeals process and the need for the land use system to produce results in accord with the planning that's been done.
All right, thank you. I do need to make a comment, Senator Whitson, now that we have on the internet that anyone, and even in the EU, can actually appeal something during the dialogue. I can only see it coming in. So thank you very much from the European Union.
I think they're reading the paper.
And Mr. Chair, with all due respect, my husband is from New Jersey. They produce some fine people in New Jersey. So.
All right, any other comments or questions?
Just one. What drove me to this initially was an attempt at building a golf course down near Brookings, which has been so hard hit by this economic downturn and the lack of fishing and lack of timber production. And the protests from outside of Curry County slowed the process so much they gave up. And something like that is tragic. And we need to make the system work better. And the other thing I do want to say on the record is I'm not disparaging LC for the way they wrote the bill. They wrote the bill the way I wanted it. But I fully intended to bring people who know a whole lot more about this in to help make the bill what it needs to be. So,
all right.
LC did a fine job. They did what they were asked.
All right. Thank you. Gentlemen, thank you very much. Is there anyone else who wanted to give testimony today on SB 186? Sean.
Adrian. All righty. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Sean Jillian's representing the Friends of Oregon Realtors, Oregon Association. I just thought we needed a friend in there.
We need friends always.
Yeah. We appreciate Senator Cruz bringing this bill forward, and I apologize for not signing up, Mr. Chair. I had to deal with a 7-year-old and school being out today. But we have been involved in the conversations on the House side. I actually brought my notes directly from that. As you heard, there were 3 bills that were opened on that side, and we're working on amendments on that. We'd be happy to work with Senator Cruz on amendments on this bill. We think it's a very important issue. It's one that we stressed to the Big Look Task Force, even when they were addressing our land use system, that standing needed to be addressed. I just make 2 quick points. You heard the speed at which LUBA works, and we absolutely think that LUBA is a great process. However, the problem is LUBA typically remands things. And so what you have is it goes back to the local level, then they can appeal again, and it goes back up to LUBA, and it goes back. And you have all these stories of people who took 4 or 5 years to do small projects, and they end up, as Senator Cruz said, giving up. And the other thing I would just put on the record, Mr. Chair, is we definitely support citizen participation in the process, and that is very appropriate at the local level. There's nothing in this bill that limits their ability to participate in the local level when the decision is made. What we're talking about here is who should have access to the court system and standing to appeal. And with that, I'd answer any questions, Mr. Chair, and I look forward to working with the committee.
Yeah, let me, and I'm going to go ahead and put a question out, Sean, and I should have asked this more for John just to make certain we're there. So is it my understanding for a land use decision, there's two options to contest a decision at the local level, either LUBA or directly going to circuit court? Or how do you get to circuit court? And John, why don't you come up? I just want to get this on the record since there is some discussion.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the question of whether you go to LUBA or circuit court, land use cases, if you fall within the statutory definition of a land use decision, which is set out in 197.015, I believe, you're at LUBA. if you're appealing. The only way you get to circuit court, I think, is if you have a statutory authority to do so under, like, Measure 3749. Some of those cases went to circuit court for determinations. But by and large, if you're in land use, you are at LUBA.
Okay. The only reason I think Scott and, or Stephen made a statement, at least I interpreted, that he basically said that have people who were going to the circuit court and make them go to LUBA. So I just assumed that meant that they had a direct route. So let's do that. I want to make sure.
We'll have all the attorneys up here.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, I hope we can get CLE credit for this. I hope.
Bill Krasinski.
We'll go for an hour. It's not worth it.
Chair Krasinski, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Steve McCoy. There are certain decisions that go to LCDC. Generally, these are kind of your larger decisions. Do with large changes to comprehensive plans, UGBs, those sorts of things. Those actually don't go to circuit court either, but they don't go to LUBA. They go to LCDC. LCDC makes a decision, and then that appeal actually goes to the Court of Appeals.
Right. Okay.
There are also, for example, Measure 37. Mm-hmm. Measure 37 was written so that all of those went to circuit court. So, yes, by and large, land use decisions do go to LUBA, but there's also, especially the big decisions that go to LUBA.
Few exceptions to the general rule.
Yeah.
Essentially, Mr. Chair, if it goes to LCDC, if there's a urban growth boundary change or a periodic review order, if the commission itself is making the determination, calling balls and strikes, the, like Mr. McCoy mentioned, the big picture stuff, that goes from LCDC as a state agency making a determination directly to the Court of Appeals. But that's not typically the sort of thing that Senator Cruz's bill would be addressing, because I believe the statutory is actually being amended with land use decisions, which are the permitting processes at the local level, and those do go to LUBA.
Okay. John, you can please stay here. And first, are there any other questions for this panel, Senator Wissett?
Thank you, Chair Prusinski. For Mr. McCoy, under Measure 37, I believe all, it's my understanding that all the claims of Measure 37 have been either resolved or replaced by Measure 49, and they're no longer germane. So I'm not quite sure why you brought Measure 37 up.
Oh, I was just bringing that up at the hearings on the House side for HB 2181, HB 2182, and HB 2610. Some cases that were held up in circuit court under Measure 37, that was a big issue that day. So I just wanted to go ahead and get that on the record today, that Measure 37 did go to the circuit court and not to LUBA. So
I took that as a comment historically how some cases went to circuit court versus going to LUBA.
Yes.
Based on how that stuff was written.
And Sean? Mr. Chair, far be it from me to defend Thousand Friends Morgan, but there are about 60 cases left, Senator Whitsitt, under the vested right theory, which I would say are more in the line of Measure 37 claims to see whether or not. And that's been whittled down from 600 some claims, but there are 60 left that are dealing with vested rights that are in the Court of Appeals.
Thank you.
Thank you. John, I'm going to have you stay up here since you're going to give testimony on the next bill. Gentlemen, thank you very much. We'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 186. We're going to open up our last public hearing for today, Senate Bill 592.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 592 allows award of attorney fees for appeals of administrative decisions, provides temporary process to seek such award retroactively in cases where order of denial entered on or after January 1st, 2009. An amendment was requested and received and distributed in hard copy this morning, although it was available from LC much sooner, so my apologies for that. This amendment would apply the measure prospectively. Oregon statutes that allow or require awards of attorney's fees in civil actions are construed to allow awards for the appeal of those actions so long as the underlying action commenced in a court. Senate Bill 592 would also allow an award of attorney fees for appeals of underlying administrative decisions.
John, you want to go ahead and get started? I may want to supplement after you finish.
Mr. Chair, your amendment basically takes away the retroactivity.
That's correct. And I'll go into why.
Okay.
John?
Mr. Chairman, members, John Chandler, Oregon Home Builder Association, supporting Senate Bill 592. I just looked at the amendments, and Mr. Chairman, I would like to hear your commentary on them. I think the bill does correct an oversight that's been in the statute for quite a while as to why you'd get attorney's fees if you go up one path and not attorney's fees, but another path. As you all know, these sorts of proceedings are very expensive. I don't know the policy basis behind the gap that's in the statute at all. It's one that we've been troubled by, but not enough to actually do anything about. Glad the bill's here. We support it and urge your passage, and that'll conclude my remarks.
Surprisingly, my guest...
I was wondering if he was going to show up.
He's going to be here. Mel, once you get situated, and we've just started taking testimony on this bill. I apologize that I guess Senator Atkinson's office may not have gotten word to you, or you got tied up, or whatever it was.
They notified me 30 minutes ago.
Well, I called 45 minutes ago because I didn't see you in the room. All right, if you could please identify yourself for the record.
My name is Mel Stewart. I live at 5180 Zozel Avenue here in Salem.
And I'm going to let you catch your breath. Basically, Mr. Stewart came to my office. Senator Atkinson introduced a bill, 592, or I should say this bill, on his behalf. We had a conversation, which I would expect that he's going to give us a little overview of how he got caught up in the system of doing some development here in the city of Salem, and how his case went, and he basically was awarded attorney fees from the lower decisions that were made through the administrative law process. But when it went up on Court of Appeals, there was a determination based on the term of art that's used in the statutes. It said judicial review versus a court appeal. He was not awarded his cost and his attorney fees at the Court of Appeals, which was somewhat substantial, and it seemed like the court said, based on how it's written, he can get it at the lower level, but he couldn't in the other. So, Mr. Stewart, hopefully you've got your breath and you can do a little bit better job than I just did.
Would you be more interested in hearing how this affects me or part of the legislative history of how Senate Bill or the state statute 19.440 came about?
I don't think we need the history. What I think is more important is for you to tell us how this impacted you, and we can fill in the blanks that we need to fill in. And I guess the other thing I'm going to tell you, we do have other business today, so, you know.
Since I retired, I went to Oregon State University, got a degree in engineering, worked my way through college as a licensed general contractor building houses, and after I retired from engineering, I decided to build some rental houses for retirement income. And one of the things you want to do in rental housing is to produce a good value for the consumer. And part of that value is having, when you build something, not only having excellent building costs, but actually working with a lower cost parcel of land. To accomplish this, we found that by going into the city and finding underutilized parcels of land, approximately 1 acre in size, and then partitioning them into three parcels, we can produce an excellent building lot that we can use to produce an outstanding value for the consumer. Before we purchase a piece of land, we first tie it up in an earthman agreement. We draw up a full partitioning set of plans. We go down to the local planning department. We go through the entire thing. Is this something we can do? Is this outright permitted? Is there any problem with doing this? And once we're given the go-ahead there, we come back the next day and we check with another planner. We go through the entire same process to make sure we haven't made any mistake. And next of all, we review everything in their land development code to make sure it favors this as an outright permitted use. The problem that comes about is that in many cases, partitioning land inside a city, particularly in an older neighborhood, is controversial. But this is what our statewide land use planning process seeks to encourage, better utilization of land inside the urban core. Anyway, so in this case, we got an approval from the planning director, met all the rules. We then got an appeal to the city council based upon the neighborhood just not liking it in their neighborhood. Decision was reversed by the city council. We appealed to LUBA. LUBA reversed the decision of the city and ordered them to grant the approval, ordered them to pay our attorney's fees. The city responded with filing an appeal. The appeal wasn't of substantial merit, but nevertheless, we had to hire an attorney to defend it. It cost me about $25,000. The decision was affirmed, but you just can't pass along a $25,000 item like this to the consumer. I mean, you just can't do it. And small businesses just cannot take this kind of hit. You have to depend upon a city abiding by its land development code that is put in place.
Mr. Stewart, just for clarification, when you were in front of the Court of Appeals said the award of attorney fees was appropriate in the lower administrative process, but because you are now in a court of law, they interpreted the statute to not apply to their review of a judicial or a judicial review of that proceeding. Is that correct?
That's correct. We got our attorney's fees at LUBA, but not at the Court of Appeals. 19.440, the original statute that passed the legislature by broad support, used the word appeal. And at that point in time, the word appeal was broad in nature. It included administrative and other, just going from a lower tribunal to an upper tribunal, the same definition that you would find in Black's Law Dictionary or the Webster's Third Edition. Since then, the definition has migrated a bit. And in addition to about 10 years ago, there was a housekeeping amendment to ORS 197-850 put forward by the trial court administrator, just doing a housecleaning amendment to the underlying statute, and they changed the word appeal to judicial review. There was no indication that they had any intent to remove the the attorney's fees on appeal, but that housekeeping amendment.
Housekeeping bills need to be looked at really carefully.
All right, so thank you. Are there any questions for Mr. Stewart? All right, let me just put on the record, the Dash 1 amendments, what it will do will make it prospective. The original bill would allow for individuals such as Mr. Stewart and anyone else who may have gone through this process to have a 90-day window to fall for trying to recover those. That is one of those situations that I personally don't feel comfortable opening the door, not knowing what is going to be behind that and what type of impact and it's going to have. To me, it's one of these things that we now have an issue that's before us. We can correct it, and it should be for future situations and not going back in time. That's the reason for the Dash 1s. Thank you, Mr. Stewart. And Mr. Stewart and I did talk about that. He understood that. Yes. I was going to take that position.
It's reasonable.
All right. Thank you. John?
Unless there's questions, Mr. Chairman, I've concluded.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much.
And that's going to, is there anyone else who wanted to give testimony today on Senate Bill 592? Not seeing one. We'll close that public hearing. And now we're going to go into taking care of some of our work session matters. And I will go ahead and open up our first work session on Senate Bill 379.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 379 was heard on February 17th. There's no revenue impact, no fiscal impact, no subsequent referral. It's the bill that allows active members to file statements of candidacy for positions on the Oregon State Bar's Board of Governors or House of Delegates. Declares an emergency as effective on passage. Previous discussion was basically the nominal value of the signature requirement on those petitions and versus the burden it created for the person seeking the position.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 379 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
All right, Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 379 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. And does anyone want to volunteer for this one? I'll just go with Senator Dingfelder.
I like taking the easy ones.
And we'll close that work session. We'll open up our next work session for Senate Bill 380.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 380 was also heard on February the 17th. No revenue impact, no fiscal impact, no subsequent referral. It's the measure that suspends a person's membership in the Oregon State Bar for failure to file annual certification and other disclosures regarding lawyer trust accounts. Declares emergency effective on passage. Previous discussion was the appropriateness and proportionality of a disciplinary response versus an administrative response in this instance. The analogy for failure to pay annual dues on time, and that the measure includes notice in 60 days to cure prior to the suspension.
All right, thank you.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 381 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 380 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
381.
Wasn't it?
380. Oh, I was looking at the wrong one.
Okay, fine.
380. Let me say 380.
Then. All right. Okay. As he said, 380 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. And Senator Ron Meachie, would you be our carrier on 380?
All right. Well, thank you, Mr. Chair.
And we'll close that work session. We'll open, work session, our last one on Senate Bill 381.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 381, also heard on February the 17th, authorizes State Professional Responsibility Board to name members of the Oregon State Bar to investigate attorney conduct and eliminates the use of local professional responsibility committees for that purpose. No revenue impact, no fiscal impact, and no subsequent referral. Previous discussion was whether the committee model was outdated for the purpose and its inherent inefficiencies and declines in volunteerism.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 381 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 381 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Even though I'm tempted to give our attorney-loving colleague that carry the bill on the floor, the chair will carry this one.
I think a member of the bar should carry this one. So
I did too. All right. With that, that concludes our work for today. We are scheduled to be here on Monday, and just to make sure the record's set, we will convene at 8:30. With that, thank you very much. Everyone have a safe and nice weekend.